Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
This month, how best to safely ditch old drugs, solar cells that use dyes rather than silicon, and...
The level of the liquid is very important because when bubbles rise towards the champagne surface, they continue to absorb CO2. So if you have a high level of liquid, you will have big bubbles at the champagne surface.
The physics of champagne fizz is on the way. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is the June 2012 edition of the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Up first, what should you do with the drugs that you no longer need? Is flushing them down the loo, which is the dealer's favoured means of disposal when the police are at the door, the best thing for the environment? Andrew Turley.
It's a big problem that a lot of people hang on to their medication, often when it's out of date as well, and the temptation to use it when it's out of date is a problem. So getting rid of old medication, unused medication, is important. A lot of people wonder what the best thing to do is, and in the US that usually means throwing it in the bin.
So that means landfill.
Yeah, so eventually ends up in landfill, and that's not great because it's getting out into the environment.
Indeed, I think there was a story a year or so ago looking at Tamiflu. They were showing, I think, several years down the stream of Tamiflu going into landfill. You could detect the molecules coming out in wastewater.
Right, and it's not just the molecules themselves. It's also as they then get broken down in the environment, they'll then form other molecules that could be just as dangerous. These are molecules that have been specially designed to interact with biological systems. When they're in the environment, that's exactly what they do. But these aren't systems that we want to interact with necessarily.
Indeed. So what's the alternative if people don't throw them in the bin?
Well, in certain parts of the world, there are long-running schemes that encourage people to take them back to the point of purchase. And then it's incinerated and dealt with properly in the same way that your batteries might be dealt with, or electronic goods are dealt with.
And I suppose the advantage of burning something is that it does get around that problem you raise of a biologically focused agent interacting with a biological system. If you burn it, that's it.
Exactly. You end up with various innocuous gases.
So what's the problem then?
Well, innocuous in terms of biological systems in the short term, but emissions go up in the longer term, they do a lot of harm.
So it's a sort of seesaw here. Do you want to favour the biology or do you want to favour the environment? So what way do we think the seesaw's tipping at the moment then?
Well, with this particular work, it's a group from the University of Michigan led by Stephen Sherlos who've looked very closely at the life cycle of these compounds with specific reference to the carbon emissions. And they make a strong case that the environmental benefit of actually just binning your unused or out-of-date medication outweighs the disadvantages.
Gosh. So actually they're surrendering or sacrificing biology.
Well, exactly. And it's a bit of a controversial idea because how do you place value on one type of harm? But these are difficult real-world situations that regulators have to deal with. And they do have to compare a hormone-disrupting or potentially hormone-disrupting chemical in the environment with carbon dioxide released and changing the climate. How do you compare those two things?
If I go and buy a piece of electronic equipment like my computer monitor, intrinsic to the cost of buying that now is an environmental cost factored into getting the bits that are bad for the environment back, recycling and so on. So they do the complete sort of life cycling in the cost. Do pharmaceutical companies have to do that? So that when you buy some penicillin or some meropenem or something and you do or don't use it, do they take that into account?
Arguably, the pharmaceutical companies don't have to look at that quite so closely. Now, if you were to go to the big pharma companies, they all have schemes to look at long-term consequences of their chemicals that they produce. But it's a very complicated business. I mean, even the chemicals that are used are a worry. I mean, in the body, they may not get consumed at all. And the ones that do may come out, they may be metabolized into equally disrupting chemicals.
So it doesn't really sound like you've got a clear answer on this one then. We've got some people who are saying it's better to throw them away, but actually there's going to be a cost whichever way you look at it?
Well, there is one clear answer, which is that whatever you do, don't flush them down the loo, which is a surprisingly common thing to do. That absorbs them into the environment very readily, but it also increases the emissions. If you put them in the bin, then it wraps them up in landfill, and a lot of that carbon will then stay within the land and not be released into the environment.
And the waste dump won't get high blood pressure or whatever was in the medication. Andrew, thank you very much. We're sticking with other kinds of interesting molecules. Silicene, maybe not such a silly name after all, though. I don't know, what is silicene?
Silicene is the new graphene, apparently. So Patrick Voigt of Berlin's Technical University in Germany and Paolo Di Padova from the Istituto di Struttura della Materia in Italy have grown a one-atom-thick layer of silicon, which they've called silicene, for perhaps the first time, they say.
Does it form little hexagonal rings like the carbon equivalent graphene does?
Well, it does appear to. You can see by the diagram they have in the paper that it does look quite similar. It's not flat, though. It's corrugated, apparently.
Ooh, so. Why is that?
I think it's something to do with the bonding.
Because they're in the same group of the periodic table, so you would sort of expect it would work the same way graphene does.
No,
have they gone as far
as
testing it yet?
They claim that it might match graphene's electrical properties, but they do say that it's difficult to predict how good it would be because they're at the beginning, that they're very much at the start of looking at this material, really.
Does the fact that it's silicon-based and a lot of electronics is silicon-based, does that mean that interfacing the two may be better or easier with this material?
That is what they say. They claim that it would be easier to integrate them into normal silicon-based circuits. Then the development of more super miniaturised electronic devices could be accelerated then from that.
The way that André Geim famously makes his graphene is peeling bits off a pencil lead with sellotape. How do they make this?
Well, it's a little different. They used vapour deposition techniques to grow this silicon layer on a silver crystal surface. And then they looked at the chemical structure and the electronics and dimensions of the material. And they claim that they are looking at silicene, whereas they say that there have been research groups that have claimed to have made silicene in the past, but the researchers are saying now that, you know, there was not enough evidence and the researchers in the past had used scanning tunneling microscopy, but this alone isn't enough to confirm, you know, the presence of silicene.
So how did they image their samples?
They looked at the chemical structure, the electronics and dimensions. They looked at bond angles and lengths, and they found that these matched density functional theory calculations.
What do they propose to do next?
Yeah, so they're just going to further investigate the properties, and they've also said that it might be worth looking at germanium as well, which would give germanicine.
Which is available from all good pharmacies, by all accounts. Oh no, sorry, that's germaline. Thank you, Eleanor. Solar technology now, and the field of dye-sensitised solar cells, which use light-absorbing dyes rather than semiconductor materials like silicon to turn light into electricity. Henry Snaith.
So a dye-sensitised solar cell, as the name may suggest, has dye in it, and the dye plays the main function of absorbing sunlight. When light shines on a material that's got colour, the reason why it's got colour is because it absorbs some of the light. And in absorbing that light, you promote electronic charge to a higher energy level. So you can imagine the sunlight comes in, it excites electrons, it promotes electrons to a higher energy. And at this higher energy, they can do work, and they can do work in the form of current and do work in an external circuit. And the purpose of a solar cell is to basically do as much work as possible from the energy that's been put into the electrons to excite them. So in a dye-sensitized solar cell, all that excitation takes place in a dye molecule, and then that dye is stuck on to the surface of an electron-transporting metal oxide. That metal oxide doesn't absorb light, but the electrons will transfer from the dye once they're excited by sunlight. They'll transfer into the metal oxide, and they'll travel through this metal oxide into an electrical circuit. So that, in essence, is one half of the device. The electrons in this circuit go around the circuit. They do work. Could be lighting a light bulb, could be powering anything really, and then they come back in the other side of the device because we have to complete the circuit, travel through a hole transporter, which is then contacted to the rear side of the die, and it goes back into the place. The electron returns to where it started, in essence. So you can imagine an electron's promoted, it's excited in a die and leaves the die. That die is then positively charged because it's lost an electron, and then it's regenerated by the electron coming back into the solar cell through the electronic circuit.
So the actual physics is not grossly different than that which we would see in a standard, what I call a standard photovoltaic that people are putting on their roofs at the moment. So what advantage does using a die rather than the current technology offer?
The main advantage is that it's extremely low cost and there's very low embodied energy in making these systems. Maybe I should just very briefly describe how, for instance, a silicon solar cell works. It's the same principle that electrons are excited in the material when it absorbs light, but now the electron transports through the same material that it's absorbed in, and also with the hole that's left behind. So you can imagine when the electron's excited, it leaves positive charge behind. That hole has to migrate through the same material. Those electrons that are in the semiconductor, in the silicon, can drop back down into the holes at any time. And this is called recombination, and this is a loss in the solar cell. And if they don't move fast enough to get out of the solar cell, they'll drop back into the holes, they'll recombine, and the solar cell won't be very efficient. And the only way to get them to move fast enough in a crystalline semiconductor is to have it extremely pure. If there's many impurities in there, the charges don't move fast enough and they recombine.
And so, that, of course, has an embodied cost, because if you're going to grow a high-purity crystal, there's going to be a labour and obviously a chemical cost to doing that.
Absolutely, and that is the critical challenge for silicon solar cells, is how do you make highly pure crystalline silicon very cheaply. In contrast with the disensitized solar cell, the light's absorbed in the dye, and then it's transferred, the electron is transferred into a material which only contains electrons. There's no holes in there. The holes are left on the dye. So those electrons can't drop down into holes, which means the electronic properties of the electron-transporting metal oxide can be very much inferior to crystalline silicon.
So what is the real rub? Why aren't we exploiting this more at the moment? Why are we going down the more costly route, which sounds altogether worse?
There's a few reasons for this. The technical reason is that the most efficient disensitized solar cells to date use a liquid electrolyte, and this is an iodide triiodide redox couple, and it's extremely challenging to make square kilometers of solar cells with a liquid sandwiched between two sheets of glass, for instance. It's extremely challenging to seal it, and it's also slightly corrosive. So there's been a lot of work over the last 10 years on developing either gelled electrolytes, solid-state electrolytes, or replacing the electrolyte entirely with a P-type organic hole conductor. And we call these solar cells solid-state disensitized solar cells. Once the efficiencies of the solid-state cells as good or better than the electrolyte cells, then it really will be a promising technology. The other reason is, of course, the solar cell only makes up a certain fraction of the overall cost of the whole system for generating and collecting the electricity from solar power. What's termed the balance of systems is, for instance, the frame, all of the inverters and electrical components to gather the power, turn it into AC electricity and put it into the grid. And this is a cost that's fixed between the technologies. So at the moment, crystalline silicon solar cell modules are between 16 to 20% efficient. And realistically, we have to have these lower cost modules have to be above 10% efficient, even if they are practically free in comparison to crystalline silicon solar cells, in order to compete. There are a few fundamental aspects or understanding of the fundamental mechanisms that are still perplexing to those researching in the field. We're fully confident that the technology could deliver 20% efficient solar cells, but there's some issues that we need to understand better in order to do that. And once that's been achieved, it will be a straightforward route to market.
So if you had to put your money where your mouth is, so it's a tricky one, this, but how far away do you think we are? When are we going to see the dye-sensitized solar cell market rivaling what we have at the moment?
There's another uniqueness for dye cells, which is advantageous over thin film and silicon technologies, is that it does come in a range of colors. It can be almost transparent, semi-transparent, and that opens up a massive possibility for building integrated photovoltaics. So what we will see is, over the next few years, 2 to 5 years, we'll see a large uptake in building integrated photovoltaics. And this is where the solar cells being used as the cladding for the buildings. So instead of using tinted glass, for instance, you will use a photovoltaic cell, which will be a disensitized solar cell. Now, the point at which it gets into competition with silicon for utility scale solar cells, I really believe that the efficiency of the modules have to get above 10% on a manufacturing line, and probably closer to 15 to really be competitive. And the timing for that, I would say within 10 years, but of course you can never judge. It might be next year if we have a lot of breakthroughs.
Oxford University's Henry Snaith. You're listening to Chemistry Worlds with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, the science of champagne and a way to give a new lease of life to drugs sidelined by solubility problems. But first, a way to make the Suzuki reaction run better. Phil Broadwith.
The Suzuki reaction is a very important reaction in chemistry. It's a way of joining molecules or bits of molecules together by making carbon-carbon bonds. To do that, you have one half of the molecule is a boronic acid. So it's a carbon, the bit that you want to join, attached to a boron, which has two OH groups on it to make a boronic acid. But those boronic acids are quite unstable in their solid form, so they don't have a very good shelf life. They're quite difficult to make. They're not easy to supply for the pharmaceutical industry to make these things. So people are looking for alternatives. One of the best alternatives is trifluoroboronate salts. So what these trifluoroboronates are is the carbon bit that you want to join attached to boron, which has three fluorines attached to it.
And how do those borons with three fluorines attached turn into the boron with the two OH groups that you need?
Well, that's a process called hydrolysis, and it's essentially a reaction with water. So you need some water in the reaction mixture. By reacting with the water, you can displace the fluorine from boron, which gives you some hydrofluoric acid, and you end up with your boronic acid, your BOH2, with the carbon bit that you want to join onto it.
And controlling the conditions to get them to react in the right way must be critical then, because otherwise you're going to get all kinds of funny things joining together that shouldn't.
Yes, well, you want to try and limit the amount of hydrofluoric acid that you're producing, because that tends to eat glassware. It's not very helpful. And if you hydrolyze the trifluoroboronate too quickly, you will produce lots of HF, but you'll also make the boronic acid, and it will then start to degrade in your reaction conditions. On the other side, if you're not doing the hydrolysis fast enough, then your reaction will go very slowly and you risk the catalyst degrading before you've had time to make enough boronic acid to complete the reaction.
So what's the solution?
Well, Chris, that's where the work that Guy Lloyd-Jones and his group at Bristol University are doing comes in. What they've done is categorise these trifluoroboronates into three groups. The first group hydrolyses very quickly, but that's not generally a problem because the boronic acids are very stable under the reaction conditions. There's a second group which hydrolyze very slowly, and there's not much you can do about that. The third group, which is the really crucial part, and that's where by tailoring your reaction conditions, you can get the hydrolysis rate just right to deliver just enough boronic acid for the reaction to keep going without it going over the top and having horrible side reactions.
So how do you do that tailoring bit?
The hydrolysis mechanism itself is quite complicated, and if you want to go into that, you're probably best off to look at the story on the Chemistry World website. But essentially, it comes down to how well you stir the reaction mixture.
Is it all in the wrist?
Well, generally we use mechanical or magnetic stirrers. But what they were saying is if you look at the shape of your reaction flask, because the reaction mixtures tend not to be homogeneous, if you have, for example, a pointy-bottomed flask rather than, say, a round-bottomed flask, you might have an area that doesn't mix quite so well, and therefore the reaction conditions get messed up and you run into all sorts of problems.
So shape as well as size is important?
Yes, absolutely. The shape is crucial, and it's really about getting the mixture. So the message, I think, from the story is to just keep stirring that Suzuki reaction.
Phil Broadwith. Champagne needs almost no introduction. But behind the pop and froth, lies a lot of science. In fact, Reims University, in the heart of the Champagne region, has its very own fizzy wine physicist in the form of Gérard Ligier-Belair, who researches what those bubbles do for the drink.
The key thing which makes champagne sparkling, bubbly, is the very high concentration of dissolved CO2 into the liquid phase, into the champagne. And this very high concentration of CO2 is brought with a specific second fermentation in the closed bottle. So the first fermentation, which is specific with all wines in the world, is the consumption of sugar in the grape juice, but during this first fermentation, all the CO2 which is produced escapes into the atmosphere because we are in open vats. But during the second fermentation, which is specific of champagne elaboration, we are in closed bottles so that the gaseous CO2 which is produced during this fermentation is literally trapped into the bottle, and a very high concentration of CO2 remains into the form of dissolved CO2 into the champagne. So we have a very high volume of about 5 liters of dissolved CO2 in each liter of champagne.
It's a lot, isn't it? Also explains why those bottles have to be so thick and heavy to avoid
Absolutely.
Exploding. What's the pressure in there?
We have a pressure of about 5 bars. So 5 times the atmospheric pressure.
Gosh, that is very high, isn't it? So when one pours out a nice glug of champagne into a glass and you see the bubbles streaming up, talk us through the process that's actually leading to the elaboration of those bubbles from various points on the glass surface.
Yeah,
and
okay.
What controls their size and so on?
Okay, so when you pour champagne into a glass, you can specifically see bubbles rising from specific points of the glass wall. The key point in the nucleation of bubble is that your glass must contain tiny particles stuck on the wall. If you have a glass perfectly clean, without any particle, without any imperfection, bubbles cannot simply nucleate. So you always have some tiny dust particles stuck on the wall. And those tiny dust particles are able to attract the dissolved CO2 to release it into the form of bubbles.
So the taller the glass, as that bubble makes its way up through the liquid, the bigger the bubble is going to become then, because the bubble itself is going to encourage more gas
Absolutely.
To move out of the
Yes.
fluid and into the bubble. So what difference does that make?
The level of the liquid is very important, because when bubbles rise toward the champagne surface, they continue to absorb CO2. So they will grow bigger and bigger during their journey to the surface. So if you have a high level of liquid, you will have big bubbles at the champagne surface.
Because those bubbles containing CO2 will impart a greater amount of acid to the flavour, because the CO2, when it goes into the mouth, is obviously an acid anhydride, and we're very sensitive to the effects of CO2 orally. So what do champagne manufacturers recommend about serving the drink? Should we have those very wide bowl-type glasses, or should we go for the taller flute?
Probably the right shape would be quite intermediate between a tall flute and a coupe with a very wide aperture. So effectively, if you have a tall flute, you will have high concentrations of gaseous CO2 above the glass, and this can be very irritating for the nose of the taster.
What about some other chemicals that come up with the CO2? Because as those bubbles are forming, there must be other volatiles and other substances from within the wine substance that will also dissolve in the CO2 and be carried out. So there
Yes.
must be an optimal passage rate for the CO2 or bubble size in order to get just the right amount of flavour coming out to give you the nose and also the right oral experience when you first drink the drink.
Bubbles grow in size because of CO2 diffusion, but obviously you have hundreds of chemical compounds in champagne which are volatile and which present aromatic compounds. So those compounds will also be able to be trapped by the bubbles during their rise to the surface, and they will be released when the bubble collapses at the liquid surface. So above a glass of champagne, you have a mix of gaseous CO2 and volatile aromatic compounds. And there is probably an optimal situation when you have enough aromatic compounds and not too much gaseous CO2, which will be able to mask the perception of aromatic compounds.
Does it also depend to a certain extent on the year? Because certain wines are going to have different levels of volatiles, and therefore what works with one glass speck or one size of bubble next year, that may not work.
Yes, each champagne are not the same. You can taste young champagne, you can taste much older champagne which have aged in cellars, and this is very different for two reasons. During the aging of champagne, there are a lot of biochemical reaction in the liquid phase which release some specific aromas, and you will have also during the aging of champagne significant loss of CO2 through the cork stopper. So when your champagne ages, it progressively loses its dissolved CO2 content and it gains with aromas.
And just as we finish, Gérard, lay one myth to rest for everybody, because you see this a lot. People write to me and they say, if I put a silver spoon in the neck of my champagne bottle in the fridge, will this stop it going flat? What is the gold standard answer?
Unfortunately, if you put a spoon in the bottleneck of your open bottle, whatever the metal of the spoon, gold, silver, or I don't know what, it will have absolutely no effect on the dissolved CO2 content. The liquid will lose its CO2 with or without your spoon in the bottleneck.
Right, well, I shall have to remove that spoon when I get home. That was Reims University's Gérard Ligier-Belair. They say you should always use the right tool for the job, and the same goes for glassware for chemical reactions. But what if you haven't got the thing you need? Well, no problem, because a new technology means that you can print out a suitable reacting vessel. Phil.
Chemists are a fairly traditional bunch, and they tend to like to stick to their round bottom flasks and beakers and all of that kind of stuff. But Lee Cronin at Glasgow has some fairly interesting ideas about the future of labware, and he's been playing around with a new 3D printer that he's made in his lab to make reactors that are completely different shapes, where the shape can influence the outcome of the chemistry, or you can integrate catalysts into the actual fabric of the reactor itself.
So what have they actually done?
Okay, Chris. Well, the 3D printer itself is actually just something that Professor Cronin's knocked up out of various bits and bobs. The ink of the printer, if you like, that makes up the labware is very similar to the kind of silicone sealant that you might buy to seal around your bathroom at home, because it's a quick drying polymer and it's, you know, watertight and whatever else. So what they then do is build up the thing in layers and programmed by a computer to make a specific shape of a reactor.
You said that you can put other constituents into the wall, catalysts and so on. So how do you decide where to put them, and how do you make sure they're accessible to the reaction constituents that are going on inside the flask?
Okay, well, that's again part of the kind of design through the computer program. But I think in this case, the catalyst just is suspended in the whole of the ink. And by its very nature, some of that is going to be in contact with the solution. So you'll have catalyst accessible. And the catalyst that they used in this case was palladium supported on particles of carbon. So that just kind of distributes itself through the ink, and you have some palladium available on the surface of the reaction flask to do hydrogenation reactions without adding any specific catalyst.
Why is this better than your traditional round-bottom flask? And how do you decide, or how do you model what sort of shapes you need?
One of the interesting things that they've done with this that you really couldn't do with a round-bottom flask is to influence the chemistry by designing the shape and volume of the reactor itself. So the team took reactors that had reservoirs for two different chemicals and different amounts of the two different chemical constituents. One there was 1 mil of, and one that there was 3 mils of. So if you let all of that mixture into a reactor with a very large volume, which in this case was about 9.5 mils, but only had to be more than four, you get a 3-to-1 ratio of the two components and you get one particular result out. Whereas if you design, if you put them into a similar reactor with only a 2 mil volume, when you draw the reactants in, you only get, there's only enough space for 1 mil of each, and therefore you get a 1-to-1 mixture and a different result at the end of the chemistry. So so just by designing the shape and arrangement of the reaction equipment, you've changed the chemical outcome. There's scope for a fair amount of chemistry to go on there. It's quite an exciting possibilities.
It certainly is. Thank you, Phil. And from round bottom flasks, or what once was a round bottom flask, to a round bottom molecule, Eleanor, tell us about this.
Well, there are a lot of potential drug molecules that have got through the stages where they've been proven to have high biological activity. But unfortunately, they've fallen at the next hurdle in tests. They've been rejected because of low solubility, so they can't be used in the body. So scientists now are working on improving the solubility of these candidate compounds. And one way that they're doing this is by making a molecular container that can encapsulate the drug molecules and increase their solubility.
Oh, I get it. So you can't use the drug in its native state, but you have this molecule which will lock onto the drug and help it to dissolve.
Yes.
But what does that do to the drug's action? Does it affect the bioavailability or the actual ability of the drug to do what it was designed to do?
They've not gone so far as to prove that yet, but at some stage I would imagine that the drug would dissociate from the molecular container. So the new container has low toxicity and can be built from readily available reagents. So it's a macrocyclic molecule made up of units of bicyclic glycoural monomers, and it's shaped like a C shape. The ends of the C's, they've been capped with sulfonated aromatic groups, and this allows greater interaction with aromatic guests, and it increases the structure solubility as well. And so the new C shape is most suitable for binding, so it can capture the drug molecules and bind to it.
And if you look at the structure of these cocobutyryl molecules, are they regarded as safe generally in the body and in biological environments? Do we think that they pose no threat? Because that's the other obvious important thing for a drug that you intend to put into the body.
They do say that the container appears to have low toxicity.
So fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Can it take pretty much any drug? Is there any restriction on the kind of thing it will work with?
So they did test 10 drugs with poor solubility. And they found that their solubility was increased by 23-fold in the lowest case, up to about 3,000-fold in the highest. And the greatest increase was for the cancer drug Taxol.
From yew trees. And so it works with an agent that's already, we know, in use.
Yeah. Yeah.
And is also very big. Taxol's
yes.
massive, isn't it?
Yeah.
As molecules go.
Yeah.
So what's the next step?
Well, they now need to work with drug companies who are doing high-throughput screening of drug candidates, and they suggest revisiting some of the candidates that have been rejected.
Eleanor Richards with the antidote to a previously unusable, insoluble drug. And now, as we draw to a close this month, a story to get positive about, even though it concerns neutrons. Phil.
OK, Chris. Well, while astrophysicists all around the world at the moment are trying to figure out where all of the mass in the universe comes from and what dark matter is, around 80 years ago this year, some physicists were struggling with a similar problem, only on a much smaller scale. It's like where all of the mass in atoms comes from.
So they knew what protons were. They could add the mass of those up. And they obviously can't weigh an electron, it's very small, but they could work out basically that there was a disparity. Some atoms weighed a lot more than the number of protons should have suggested.
Exactly, Chris. Well, if you think of carbon, it has an atomic mass of 12, but it only has 6 protons. So there's 6 units of mass missing somewhere. And that's what James Chadwick managed to solve in 1932 when he proved the existence of the neutron.
So it's 80 years of the neutron this year.
Absolutely, Chris. Yep.
Do you know actually how he went about proving that?
Well, yeah, it's a relatively simple experiment in that if you take something like beryllium and bombard it with alpha radiation, so that's helium nuclei, 2 protons, 2 neutrons. Beryllium has 4 protons and 5 neutrons. When the two crash together, you make a carbon nucleus, which has 6 protons, 6 neutrons, gives you 1 neutron left over. So it shoots out a load of neutrons. Marie Curie's daughter Irène Joliot-Curie and her husband had found this very penetrating radiation coming out of beryllium when it was bombarded with alpha particles. And they put some paraffin wax in front of this radiation and saw that the radiation would knock all of the hydrogen atoms, protons, out of the paraffin wax, which gave them something that they could measure. But what James Chadwick did, was measure the energy of that protons that came out of the paraffin wax, which by conservation of momentum he could work back to prove that the radiation coming out of the beryllium was something that had the same mass as a proton but was neutrally charged.
And on that note, we must bid you farewell. Thank you to the Chemistry World team, Phil Broadwith, Eleanor Richards and Andrew Turley, and to our guests, Henry Snaith and Gerard Ligier-Belair. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. We'll be back with more cutting-edge chemistry next month. For now, though, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.